It's time for what Podcast International called the greatest podcast in history. Open your ears, because it's time for Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.
And welcome to Man Thoughts. This is Brian Callen, and I just want to remind people or tell people, like I've said it before, I will be at the Minneapolis House of Comedy September 19th, 20th, 21, 22. That's in Minneapolis House of Comedy, I think in the Mall of America. It's a great room, so come say hi. I will be bringing the heat. Well, anyway, since we're talking Man Thoughts, it's my new brand, here's a couple things. First of all, if you guys can come up with a t-shirt idea for Man Thoughts, I need one desperately. And if you do, I'll give you $500 and I will wear it after I make you sign all the rights away to me. Speaking of Man Thoughts, my guest is Kieran Gallagher, and he's a professional stuntman in Hollywood, and he used to fight professionally. And he's a good buddy of mine. We worked together on Death Valley. And he's a very smart guy, but a very understated guy. He doesn't really like talking. So the goal of this podcast is to get Kieran to talk about everything about that he knows about stunts, what it's like to be a professional stuntman, what it's like to be a pro fighter. And I will say that I watched the UFC with Kieran a number of times, and he not only called every single fight, but actually told me what the guy was going to do before he did it. And I mean, that was pretty remarkable. And so since he's been teaching me a little bit of boxing and a little bit of Greco-Roman and jiu-jitsu, and it's been a lot of fun. And I realize what a pussy I am every time I'm around him. Kieran, what's up? Welcome to to Brian Callen's Man Thoughts. Or should I say Man Thoughts with Brian Callen?
It's an honor.
Hey, dude, you're working on Hangover 3 right now.
Yeah, and I was actually on Hangover 2 with you.
Yes.
I forgot to mention.
That's right, and you worked on Hangover 2, but I didn't know you then.
That's true.
And you're doing driving stunts for Hangover 3?
In this one, I'll be doing a lot of driving, yeah.
How'd you get into being a stuntman?
It's kind of a funny story. I got into stunts. You know, I always did physical activities when I was young, and I kind of need that... Kind of need that to be kind of happy and well balanced, you know. So
yeah, because basically you came from a family, I believe, of seven.
Yeah,
seven. Irish, fresh off the boat, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Pretty much.
How many brothers?
There's five boys and two girls. Yeah,
that's and you were the youngest.
I'm the puppy. Yeah, I'm the youngest in the litter. Yeah. So
what was that? That before we go into being a stuntman, one of the things I noticed about you is that you see a lot of danger where I don't. Like, you're very good at picking up irregularities in the landscape, as it were. And that probably comes from having to fend for yourself and having to fight for everything from food to clothes, right?
Yeah, well, you know, when you're the lowest in the totem pole, you tend to take all the brunt of everybody's misdeeds. You know, any dysfunctions in the house definitely land on your shoulders. So, you know, you learn how to deal with those types of things. So,
good. That's really descriptive. You're clearly private about your fucking family life. When you're a little guy in a totem pole, you just learn how to do that. That's what tough guys like you are actually like. You're very understated. There's never really a lot of talk. It's just more about doing. But going to being a stuntman, how did you become a stuntman?
Well, like I said, I always needed, for me, I kind of need something that's more physical, challenging. If I'm not learning or challenging myself, in business and finance and all those things are fun and well to do, and at the end of, I'm fairly adept at them, but at the end of the day I need to challenge myself physically, and that's what I'm more comfortable with.
Why do you think that is?
It's just what I've always kind of grown up doing, you know. I grew up in a very stereotypical household where to be a man was to be able to beat some ass, pick up a lot of chicks, and cut the rug when needed. That's
traditional fucking Irish
stuff.
Yeah,
those were the key elements for success.
Yeah,
you could knock out another man's tooth and cut the rug in the same night. You're on
cut
your
the
way.
Rug meaning being able to dance.
Yeah,
are you going to tell me you know how to dance, motherfucker? Because you're not a better dancer. You can kick my ass, but you cannot dance better than me.
I'm pretty much going to dominate you in all aspects,
bro. I'll have a dance off with you right now, brother. All right, you're lucky there's no salsa music playing right now.
End up well for you.
Yeah, I'm ready. I take that challenge. I'm not gonna tie up with you, and I sure as hell ain't gonna strike with you. But I will fucking out dance you.
You certainly
bro.
Won't salsa with me either.
You're out of your mind. All right, well, this is. I'll do a video. All right, we'll have a video dance off, and I'll post it on my website. So keep going. So you felt like you were, you know, you basically that's how you expressed yourself. It was your language,
well,
right?
It's just kind of what you were growing. That was kind of what you expected to, you know.
What a man was.
Yeah, you know, your stereotypical, prototypical, you know, iconic image was kind of like plastered all over where I grew up. And
you grew up in Massachusetts, right?
I grew up, in Mass, about 45 minutes outside of Boston, and a pretty heavy Irish community. And so, you know, you had these stereotypical...
The Irish are macho. There's not a lot of room for feminine energy in an Irish man, especially in those communities, right?
Yeah, generally. Yeah, it's not really encouraged. Wearing colors or anything that's not gray, blue, or black is...
It's true. It's in an Irish neighborhood like that. I always say that you can get your ass kicked by wearing the wrong shirt. You can walk in wearing a funky hat and you know, and leather pants. You're getting the shit kicked out of you in a bar if somebody's drunk a lot of times, right?
Or sober.
Or sober.
Yeah. Definitely happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that. I'm very aware of that. I spent enough time in Massachusetts. I went to high school out there, so I know. I'm sorry, but keep going.
So, yeah, you kind of grew up with that background. So, you know.
But you got into, you were a professional fighter first. I mean, you got into.
Yeah, I started at a very young age fighting professionally.
Boxing, right?
No, I grew up boxing, but I actually went professional in kickboxing at a very early age. Then I switched over to Muay Thai at a very early age. And then when I finally moved west and went to college, and then I got into wrestling and Greco and judo and jiu-jitsu a little bit more, and then started to do a lot more like well-rounded fights.
And how did you do in jiu-jitsu? You won some tournaments, right?
I did pretty good. I ended up winning a national championship in 95.
Not bad. And who were your teammates? I think you were on the same team as Ensign Inoue and...
The Inouye brothers, the Inouye brothers back then, Bob Bass, really kind of the who's who, the beginning founding guys back in the day. You know,
so you were kind of in the, you're 40 now, you were in the sort of early part of MMA, and you fought in Japan, and did you fight, where else did you fight?
I did some fights in Brazil, I did some in Mexico, here in the United States, and then Japan.
You know a lot about MMA, and I think you game plan for some guys, but MMA has really, really evolved and changed a great deal, right?
Not really.
Really?
No. Well, for you as a fan, yeah, it's changed a lot because what you're exposed to has changed. But what
hold a mic in front of your face.
But what has been needed, really, what skill sets have been needed haven't changed from day one. It's just you haven't got an opportunity to see those skill sets until recently. Like being a well-rounded striker and being a well-rounded grappler and all these things, from day one, those were the necessities. Those are the tools you needed. You just couldn't find guys that had those tools.
They were either good wrestlers or good strikers and nothing in between.
A majority of the guys were coming out of Brazil with a really strong jiu-jitsu background, or they had a shoot-the-box background, or you got guys coming out of the Midwest with really strong wrestling backgrounds. So... you know, they were always lacking in a lot of areas.
Right. And now for the first time, we're seeing guys like Rory McDonald
and stuff. Who are growing up and understanding all the skill sets that are necessary. So to find somebody who had all the skill sets back when I was around was a rarity. It was a freak. It was a freak incident. You wouldn't find guys that were well-rounded athletes. You know, there was a handful. Eric Paulson is one of the only guys that was a well-rounded guy back in the day. You know, besides that, you wouldn't have really a lot.
Besides the obvious, like GSP and Anderson Silva, who are the guys that you think not only are who do you think are the most technical fighters now that you're the most impressed with from a well-rounded point of view? Obviously, Rory McDonald, but he's very young yet.
He's very good. Jose Aldo is extremely well-rounded. He has the
We haven't seen Jose Aldo's groundwork yet, but apparently he's beaten like the world champions in jiu-jitsu. I mean, he's no joke.
But you know, there's a huge difference between sports jiu-jitsu and MMA jiu-jitsu. You know, so is that going to transition for him in the cage? Is that going to help him in the cage when he's pinned on the bottom? I don't know. You have to wait and see. But there's a massive difference between no-gi jiu-jitsu, gi jiu-jitsu and MMA jiu-jitsu, all three are very different. Mm. And a lot of people make the mistake of comparing gi jiu-jitsu or no gi jiu-jitsu with MMA. What's going to happen in MMA? And they're not linked together.
Because whatsoever. MMA jiu-jitsu has knees and elbows and fists.
Yeah, it's very hard to pull off stuff when your guy's pounding you in the grill with elbows. So, you know, a lot of the things you're trying to set up a guy with that you can do in no-gi, you don't really get an opportunity to set that up when a guy's raining down elbows in your grill.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so your protection positions are a lot different in no-gi jiu-jitsu than they are from MMA jiu-jitsu.
Right, right. So. Let's get back to stunts. What is your specialty? I know fighting is, and I know that firsthand because we worked on Death Valley together, and you were kind of coordinating a lot of that stuff with the great Phil Tan.
Yeah, Phil's a very good friend of mine. I was very fortunate to work with Phil for the first
time. Phil's worked on everything, you guys. I mean, you wouldn't know that name maybe because it's a... You know, a lot of these you guys are listening to other countries, but Phil Tan is an Asian guy from actually grew up in England, and he's not a big guy, but he is so well respected in the stunt world. That dude is probably 50, and he's in better shape than most 20-year-olds, and he's just good at everything. I've worked with him now twice, and on two different things, and he really knows his shit.
Yeah, the thing I like most about Phil is he's extremely relaxed on set. You know.
Right,
he doesn't get too tense or wound up or too worried about what's going on with all the he said she said stuff. He's more concerned about just getting the job done as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Well, the thing about being a stuntman, I've watched you guys a lot. One of the things that people don't realize, it's not just about being a daredevil. You also got to really have a clear understanding of camera angles.
Yeah,
what's going to work on camera? It's very technical. It's very artistic in that sense. I mean, you've got to know a lot about how a movie is shot in order to pull off a stunt, right?
Yeah, you have different levels of stuntmen, different tiers, and there's reasons why there's different tier sets and why some guys will be in the business for 20 years, and in 20 years they're still doing stairfalls and fights and they're not coordinating.
Yeah,
because they don't get certain aspects of the business. And then there's other guys who can be in the business 3-4 years and they're already coordinating because they understand certain aspects of the business. And for me, it really boils down to two things. It's skill set and IQ. Hmm. And IQ and skill set is a very fleeting commodity in the stunt business. It's very rare to find it.
Very rare to find it in life.
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, in the stunt business, it's far more important.
It was funny because when we were doing Death Valley, I remember you were like, you can just kick me. I was like, what do you mean? He goes, just hit me. Just punch me, kick me, whatever you want to do. And I was like, dude, I can kick and punch kind of hard. And you were like, yeah, I know you can. Go ahead and kick and punch me. I was like, you're a fucking asshole. Or Kieran Mate, I was going to do a stunt for Comedy Central, this thing I did called Mashup, which is coming out. And I had to rear up on a horse. And Kieran, because he's my boy, came out and watched me ride a horse. And I was showing him how I could ride a horse. And then I went to rear up on the horse. And Kieran goes, nah, you're not going to rear up on the horse. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, you're not riding that horse, dude. That horse is riding you. And I was like, fuck you. And he goes, because that horse is probably roll trained. And if it goes up and you pull the rein one way, it's going to roll on top of you and you're not going to know what the fuck to do. That's why we have stuntmen. And I remember you kind of checked me and probably saved me. You could have potentially saved my fucking life with that little, you know, because I know actors always want to do their own stunts. Guys like me who want to be a stuntman, I want to be a tough guy, so I want to do shit.
Every actor's Chuck Norris.
There's such a fundamental difference between, you know, a guy who's been in a ring or in a cage and has had to actually fight and perfect the jab and actually connect with someone's face and someone who's danced around a gym and learned how to hit mitts. Because I remember when you were teaching me how to box and I wanted to hit mitts and you were like, everybody can hit mitts, Brian. I don't give a shit about hitting mitts, okay? You're going to fucking learn footwork and you're going to learn how to jab. And I felt like I had, I don't know, I literally felt like I was underwater. I was like, I couldn't punch all of a sudden. I didn't know how to step. And I'm walking around telling people I used to fight. And it was just embarrassing.
You know,
I know enough to know the difference, at least. You know,
the problem is that's what you see. That's what you see on TV when you watch Floyd Mayweather's training camps or you watch, you know, Freddie Roach working with his fighters. You see mitt work. That's what you see. And people think, oh, that's what I got to do. I got to get mitts and I got to do these combinations. 1, 2, 3, 4. I got to do this. I got to do that. And look at this. I got a 6-punch combination. And all that stuff is really kind of worthless in reality because things aren't working like that. And in one of the things when I was growing up, and I still believe this today, and I see this not utilized, I don't care how you punch. Yeah, I'd like you to throw a good punch. I'd like to sit, have you sit down on your punches and deliver with some power. But it's not so much how you punch, it's where you punch from. What position you're in when you're punching, where you are off the guy's shoulder, his foot, or are you on the pocket, inside the pocket? Are you splitting his hands? Are you not splitting his hands? Are you lined up your lines or with his arms or not? You can throw all the combinations you want into a guy's forearms, and at the end of the day, you have done nothing but give him some bruised forearms. And if he's a good striker, he's going to counter all those, and he's going to wrap his hands right around your grill. And that's the big difference. So hitting mitts really doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot if you can't put yourself in the position to capitalize on hitting a guy.
Yeah.
You know,
it's so all about footwork, all where your position is.
Yeah.
Footwork, speaking of positioning, stunts are very much that way, because we were talking about how you position yourself in front of the camera. What are the most dangerous stunts? What are the ones that are you get paid the most for?
Well, high falls used to be one of the most dangerous stunts, but high falls have kind of gone away.
Why?
Well, because they're so dangerous and so many things can go wrong and there's so few guys that can do them well.
You have to have air awareness and all kinds of shit.
Phenomenal air awareness, huge, huge brass balls.
Because a lot of guys don't realize you have to land in one of those cushions, one of those air mats.
Airbag.
You have to land in an airbag properly, because you can go through an airbag if you don't.
Right, you can punch through an airbag. Airbag is not the save-all, catch-all. If you fall and you hit the airbag incorrectly, you can still break your neck. You can still break your back. You can still punch through an airbag. You can hit it off center and slide off the edge and punch right into the concrete. And it happens. And guys die all the time from it. So,
Jesus.
There's a few, very few guys that have a great skill set for that, who are really phenomenal, like a legendary Bob Brown or somebody of that nature.
What's the world record for the highest airbag jump?
I'd have to say, oh man, that's a tough one. There's kind of a split record. There's one from the highest elevation, which is out of a helicopter.
I heard he said that the airbag looked like a tic tac.
Yeah, you're so far up.
And that's so crazy, because I don't understand how you would know when you're that high up how you would even measure where to jump from. I mean, if you're that high up and you move 2 inches to your left, you're dead.
Well, 2 inches turns into 30 feet.
So how the fuck, when that airbag is that small, how the fuck do you do that?
Well, the guys that are doing that are world-class high divers, guys that have been diving from high heights for a long period of time. But again, when you're on a helicopter platform, like a helicopter that can slide back and forth, and you're looking,
it's crazy.
Everything looks like it's right below you when you're looking down at it at 200 feet. Or 300 feet.
No, but they're not jumping that high. No.
They are jumping that high.
They're jumping. Are you telling me that guys are 300 feet?
I believe. No. I know for sure 216 feet has been done.
216 feet has been done.
Yeah.
People don't realize how high that is. That's the craziest. That's so high. That's a bridge.
That's more than a bridge.
That's more than a bridge. That's fucking. That's how many stories is that?
Well, you figure in a commercial building, every story is about 13 feet.
Every story is 13 feet.
About 13 feet a story, yeah.
That's like 20 stories high, practically.
Yeah, that's a 20-story building.
That's the craziest. Think about how high that is. That's the craziest shit I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine that. I cannot imagine how terrifying
that
is.
Not too many guys can do it.
Yeah. And because because I remember in Sharky's Machine, remember that Burt Reynolds movie a long time ago? You probably
don't.
Yeah,
I remember.
And the guy
falls
out of the window, and it was like some crazy height.
Yeah.
And I think he was on fire even. I can't remember. But
yeah, that was Bob Brown.
That was Bob Brown. He's a badass.
He's a beast. When it comes to high falls, the guy's a savage. Yeah.
Is he still alive?
He is. He's coordinating, actually. The job I was to do in Chicago, that was for Bob Brown.
Really?
Yeah.
How old is Bob Brown now?
He's got to be 56, 57.
That's young.
In there.
Yeah. It's young.
Yeah.
So he was very young when he was doing those crazy high jumps.
Yeah, he's a stud. He's a stud.
Okay, so high jumps are very, very dangerous.
High falls. And high falls have been kind of replaced with what we call descenders. Because of the danger, now we put people on wires.
Oh, okay.
And what we do is we...
Like a bungee cord kind of thing?
No. Like a giant fishing pole.
Okay.
Imagine a fishing pole with a giant reel on it. Wow. So, you know, that reel that you let, well, imagine a giant reel. And instead of a lure on the end of it, you got a human. And you let him go. Yeah. And you have a break on it. And so you can, you know, calculate the distance you need and set the break for that distance. And the guy falls. And when he gets to the break, boom, stops.
You know what? It's still scary as fuck.
And they fail. And guys still get injured. And things happen. I mean, it's still very dangerous. Everything can fail. And everything
does fail.
Well,
one of the things that I've learned by working with stuntmen and doing, you know, having to throw stuntmen, you know, in the air. And I remember I was doing this thing in Death Valley. And I had to take Joe Arnaz, I think. You know Joe? Or what's his name?
Joe Ordaz. Yeah.
Joe Ordaz is a great guy and a big dude, man. Joe is a rough, rough guy. I mean, he's one of those guys who's just, he's probably about 230 and he had to run away from us. He is fast. I mean, he's a real athlete. I was like, look at how fast this motherfucker's running. He's 230 and then he can fight. I mean, he's like one of those guys when you're a guy like me at 170 pounds, you go, God help me if I ever got tangled up with him, because I'd lose fast, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to throw him in the air. Well, I would throw him, but he would kind of flip over my back, and he did all the throw. He would throw himself over me, basically, because I was playing a cop. And Joe, I was looking at what he had to fall into. He had to crash into it. I was like, oh, it must be breakaway stuff made of balsa wood. No, it wasn't. It was real fucking furniture. And he was throwing his body into it with a tiny pad on his back. And he kept doing it. And I couldn't believe. I was like, dude, you're actually really doing this. This isn't like, you're not falling into balsa wood. You're falling into hard furniture and actually hitting it with so much force with your 230-pound frame that you're breaking it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where I was like, that's where you earn your money, man. I mean,
that's
you get beaten up. That's a good day of work.
That's the kind of job you want. That's the day you want. You can earn your money there.
And I was watching you where I think at one point I had to slam your head, or Charlie had to slam your head into that drawer.
Yeah.
You were like, go ahead, you can slam my head in this drawer. And I was like, what do you mean slam his head? You're like, ah, you won't hurt me. It was crazy.
Well, he didn't hurt me, but here's the thing. The less athletic the actor, the more contact I let them make. Okay, no offense.
Fuck you, I'm athletic.
But here's the reason why. Because if there's multiple things going on in the scene, there's a lot of things going on in the room, all those things have to play to camera and they have to sell. They have to look real.
Right.
Well, the more things that are real,
yeah,
that's check that off the list.
Right.
We don't have to fix the angle for camera to make sure that works.
Right.
So if I'm doing this... if I'm doing a scene inside of a scene, like say there's multiple fights, or so if you're kicking my ass in one area of the room and somebody else is fighting in the other area of the room, if all the things you hit me with are real contact, then it's all a sell. Everything works.
Yeah.
So now you can check me off the list. All that works. Now we can focus on the other fights in the room and make sure they work for camera.
Right.
And so it just makes it easier for me.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, when you watch these movies that we take for granted, like The Bourne Identity or whatever, there are guys taking serious fucking welts and beatings and broken bones doing that shit.
A lot of guys get injured.
A lot of guys get injured.
People don't realize that.
I mean, I was when I was on the movie Warrior, you know, I was with you know a couple guys like Jace and those guys.
Jace is a very good friend of mine.
Yeah,
spoke to him today.
They were doing all the fighting, man, and it was grueling. It was grueling because they were kicking, hitting, throwing each other. I mean, tweaking their knees, and I mean, it was nuts, man. I mean, and Jace is a tough kid.
He fought professionally as well.
Yeah, he looks like a rough fucking dude.
Yeah,
man.
He fought out of Texas. He's a tough kid.
Yeah, so that's the one thing that I have. That's why I always end up hanging out with the stuntmen, because I know what you guys do, and it's just always so impressive to me. It's a lot more fun usually than hanging out with a bunch of actors, because all we do is make believe.
Mm.
So you know, horses. I remember you have such a healthy respect for horses.
Oh, horses will run you down. That's not a lot of stunt guys will tell you, like, and horse guys will tell you, like, you got to teach a horse who's in charge. You got to show him who's in charge, and just because if a horse realizes you're not in charge, he's gonna do whatever he wants. Well, let me tell you a secret. Horses can do whatever hell he wants, anyways.
Yeah.
Regardless of if you think you're in charge or not. And I've watched world-class stunt wranglers, guys who've been wrangling horses their whole lives, just get plowed down by their horses. You know, like, hey, whoa, fellas. And the fellas say, nah.
Yeah, you're talking about a 1,300-pound animal, right?
Yeah, I mean, just run you down like a rag doll.
That's a pretty big animal. Even heavier, I think, horses.
They're not something to play with. Horses aren't something to play with. Bears. I just did a gig with a bear the other day. Bears aren't something you really want to play with.
Bears, that one grizzly bear killed that big guy in 8 seconds.
Yeah.
Grabbed him by the neck. It was tragic. And grabbed him, and his instinct kicked in, and he shook, and that guy died in 8 seconds. That guy was 6'4". He looked like a very big guy. I think he was like 220. Yeah, I don't know how big.
Very well-known bear trainer.
He was well-known. Yeah.
And he's worked a ton.
That was a real tragedy. When you see a guy like that, who's obviously a great guy and has done a lot, get killed by an animal, you know?
And then the other, obviously, one that almost all stunt guys are nervous of is the chimpanzee.
Dude, I don't know. Chimps are so dangerous. Have you worked with chimps?
I have not. Like I said, I've done bears, I've done horses, I've even done a tiger. And out of all those animals, I fear the chimp the most. And I'm not looking forward to working with any monkey.
Because they'll bite your face off, and they'll eat your fucking hands, and they'll eat your balls.
Yeah, they will take your genitals with you. Where a tiger will kill you. But
yeah, a tiger will bite you on the neck.
He'll leave you with your genitals before you die.
Yeah. So you know about chimps. You know about that stuff?
Because
I talk about it in my stand-up.
They're crazy strong.
Well, I played with baby chimps, and they feel like wood. They feel like they're made of wood, okay? So when you're dealing with an adolescent or male or a full grown chimp, which I don't even think they let you do anymore.
No, they do. They will work on set. You will see full grown adolescents, male chimps on set.
Adolescents or full grown chimps? You see?
Both.
Yeah, that's
some of the actually more working chimps are elderly or older chimps that have been in the business a long time.
That's very scary.
Yeah,
because you're right. They are unpredictable and they will kill you.
Yeah,
and nobody's getting a chimp off you by in time. You know, a lot of times I think they have to kill a chimp to get, you know, but you're not peeling a chimp's arms off somebody. You know, no. I've always wondered what that would be like to get like someone like Brock Lesnar or somebody really strong, or my boy Shane Carwin to wrestle with a fucking like a full grown chimp. I wonder what would happen, because Shane said to me, I was showing pictures to Shane. If you Google naked chimpanzee, take a look at how muscular they are. And I said to Shane, I showed Shane. Shane's 285, and you know. But he squeezed me the other day. He picked me up and started squeezing me, and I tapped. Like, my arm actually still hurts from it, and I started tapping. And he goes, "That's 40%, bro." Okay, so Shane's a monster, and I was like, "Would you, if you muzzled a chimp, you think you could fight it?" He goes, "I don't think so, dude. I think that thing would fuck me up." And I was like, "I don't know," but
chimp would pull him apart like a piñata part.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think anybody does that to Shane Carwin because he's so big. But it's true that chimps are superhuman strong. The person at the San Diego Zoo said about chimps, she said, well, chimps have an ability to go from 1 to 10, like as in 10 being full rage fury. They have an ability to go from 1 to 10. She goes, for you to get to 10, it takes a long time to build up. She goes, a chimp can go from 1 to 10 in a couple seconds and then kill you and then come right back to 1 and eat a banana. And I was like, I see. So it's nothing personal when they rip you to fucking shreds.
No.
You know?
Sounds like an ex-girlfriend of mine.
Yeah, have you heard stories of chimps fucking people up on set? Or
no, I've
you just know that Connecticut.
Unfortunately, I haven't had any personal stories or anyone who is that I know personally has been involved with chimps. But you know, you just grew up. You know, you've grown up and you've seen the news and you've seen what chimps can do. And
it's scary.
And you're always dreading that you're going to be stunt doubling some guy, guest starring Bobo the Chimp.
Yeah.
And you got to deal with him.
Well, you know, when I was doing Mad TV one time, they brought a lion down on set, and it was for a commercial for, I think, Merrill Lynch or some shit. And everybody couldn't understand why I wouldn't pet it, and I was hiding upstairs in my room. And I was like, I'll tell you why. That's a 520-pound male lion, and let me explain something to you. If that thing decides to fuck with you, this trainer over here with the mustache, he's just food with a mustache, okay, to a lion. Because if a lion's instinct kicks in and decides to eat me or bite me in my neck, Yoker guy over here, the lion man, ain't going to do a thing. He's going to be whipping it and trying to get it off, and it ain't going to happen.
The only thing he's
going
to be doing is apologizing to your family.
That's right.
For not being able to get that lion off your noggin.
That's exactly right. So, no thanks. I won't be messing with a lion.
Yeah.
People that don't have respect for animals crack me up. But one of the things about being a stuntman, I always noticed, you guys have such a healthy respect for routine and for the details and for safety. I mean, that's always like so important.
Well, you know, unfortunately, it's like any industry. You have your good and bad.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're going to have a section of any industry that's mediocre at best.
Yeah.
You know, subpar at the least.
Well, because there's a lot of pressure and there's time constraints and you're moving quickly and you guys are expendable. You know, stuntmen are expendable in some ways.
That's exactly why we're there. Exactly why they're there. We're there because if you get injured, nobody works.
Yeah.
Because nobody's filming. The grips aren't working. The light guys aren't working. Camera guys are sitting around at Crafty because you're injured. There's no one to film. If I go out there and I get injured,
they
just get on the phone and call another guy that looks very similar to you.
Yeah.
And you're still safe in your trailer and everybody's got a job. But if you get injured, now everybody's out of a job. So we are extremely expendable, but that's what we sign up for. And for us to complain about it would be kind of ridiculous.
I was impressed with the caliber of stuntmen on Death Valley. I mean, you had women that were Olympic gymnasts and guys who were Olympian. That one guy who was an Olympic, Johnny Depp's double, who was an Olympic trampolinist, Theo.
Yeah.
I mean, we had some. Then you had just big thug guys who were good at kind of playing zombies. But there were some skilled dudes. I mean, with real pedigree, you know, real resumes. I mean, really athletic resumes.
Again, it's
like yourself.
Yeah. Again, there's there's a real leveling. You really can look at stunts as like any sport from high school to professional.
Uh-huh.
You got your high school level athletes, you got your college level athletes, you got your international level athletes, and then you have your pros. And it's the same thing in the stunt community. You're going to have guys that are at all different levels. And with Phil working on Death Valley, he had the option to bring in whoever he wanted.
Yeah.
He'd bring in the
top. I got to meet the legendary Gene LaBelle.
Yeah,
top that was food awesome. Chain. I didn't even know who he was. I was talking about fighting, and Gene LaBelle sitting there getting makeup on, and the idiot over here, Brian Callen, the actor, I'm spewing off. I'm parroting. You know, basically when I talk about fighting, it's because I have a good memory and I hear my fighter friends talk like you, and then I'll just parrot them and steal all their info. and I'm really good at that, so I sound like I know what I'm talking about. And Gene LaBelle's like piping in some once in a while, and I'm like, who's this old guy talking over me? You know, and then I find out he's Gene LaBelle, and I was like, oh God, the legendary Gene LaBelle who choked out Steven Seagal, who's been fighting for 50 years. Yeah. He's awesome, man. He was such a great guy. It was so fun to him. And that guy was showing me shit. He was just hurting me. He'd like shake my hand and fuck me up. He'd do these weird things. He was just showing me all his little tricks. He's got 1,000 nasty tricks, that guy.
Gene is a very interesting character. He's really he's first no-holds-barred fighter, really, in the U.S. I mean, if you really want to go way back.
Really?
He's the first. If you want to really go way back, he's the first MMA guy in America. He really is.
Wow.
He did a fight with a boxer. He fought judo, and the boxer fought boxing.
That was what Gene was. He was judo?
He's a judo player, yeah. He's a very accomplished judo player, and he also did catch wrestling, and he did professional wrestling.
Huh.
Pro wrestling.
He's a gorilla, dude. He's built like a gorilla. He's got long arms, strong, big hands.
Very strong guy in rough and tumble. He really was, again, he's the godfather of rough and tumble, you know, fighters in the movie business. I mean, really, he was the first.
He's a real tough guy. Like, you know,
he's got a mean streak in him. Don't be, do not let his sweet old man demeanor kid fool you. He is a savage and he likes to hurt guys.
Yeah.
He giggles and he thinks it's just keen and he loves it. And,
he's awesome.
You know, I met Gene 15 years ago when he was, you know, a little younger, and he was torquing on guys, young guys then, and just having a ball.
Yeah,
people say, oh, Gene's so nice. Gene's nice, but if Gene could get you in a position where he could squeeze you a bit, he'd be even happier. You know, he'd have a big smile on his face.
Yeah, he's great. I mean, he did that to me, and he was 80 at the time.
Oh, he loves it.
Yeah, he's amazing. Gene, I guess, have you ever worked with Steven Seagal or any of those guys?
No, I haven't worked with Steven Seagal. His kind of career kind of ended before I came into the business. I mean,
what is your take on his sort of teaching Anderson Silva front kick? And you're a fighter. I mean, Boss Rutten went crazy on him, but maybe you don't even want to say anything about it. I don't know, but it's a little strange. It seems very strange to me. I don't know.
As I will probably never work on a Steven Seagal film, And if I never do, I'm not going to lose sleep over it. It's not going to be something I lose sleep over, because he's a bit careless anyways and tends to hurt a lot of stunt guys.
Yeah.
Because he's so careless. He's really, again, he's an actor. That's what he does. That's his craft.
He'll tell you he's been a fighter his whole life, but he's never been in a ring. I mean,
you know, that's a difficult statement to really, you know, to address. He's been a fighter his whole life. What is he fighting? Obesity? I'm not sure exactly what this fight he's been doing his whole
Every
life.
Every fighter I talked to is always like, where did he fight?
I'm not sure what he's fighting. Is it, you know, I don't know.
See, you know, yeah, you have trouble with that statement, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, has he gotten himself in some fights in Japan? Probably. I lived in Japan, and I can tell you they don't really like foreigners there very much. So probably he had some fierce battles with some 135-pound Japanese drunk men. Probably, you know, at 6'4", it probably was a battle for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I could see, you know, him claiming to be this.
But he was an Aikido guy, I guess.
Aikido, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we'll leave that alone, because I think it's been done to death by some other guys as well. So
yeah.
I don't want to, you know.
But his whole thing is teaching Anderson Silva. Well, Anderson Silva's been in the sport for, you know, almost 10 years now.
Longer.
Where was Steven Seagal when Anderson Silva was fighting in Pride? Where was Steven Seagal when Anderson won the UFC title from Rich Franklin?
Right, obviously.
Where was he then when he was clinching and kneeing people to death?
Right.
I can't remember seeing him there. maybe I missed him. I don't know. Maybe
you might have. Yeah.
He's very elusive.
He's very very elusive, man. He's like a ninja, dude.
You
never know. You never know.
I think he's just lost touch with reality a bit, and I think he thinks that maybe the rest of and unfortunately, there's a huge segment of the populace that will buy into this whole Steven Seagal thing. People want to buy
I wonder.
Into that mysticism.
I wonder, though, because I think he's gotten a lot
secrets.
Of flack for it, and I wonder. You know, I think people are probably nowadays who are savvy about MMA know what it takes. And, you know, my take on it is, have you been in a cage or a ring? Can I see some tape on you? Who have you fought?
Yeah.
And when I see you do that, then I'm gonna be looking at you differently. But if you taught karate or just, you know, Aikido or something, I'm going to have a hard time believing that you're, I mean, it's hard to say, it's hard to earn that right. I always, you know, look, man, I did Taekwondo and competed all over the country, and we kicked each other in the head, and we didn't wear pads, but I never punched anybody in the face. So I would never tell someone like you that I was a fighter, because you'd chuckle. I was talking to fucking Nate Marquardt about this. I was saying, you got to earn the right to call yourself a fighter. I know enough to know that I certainly wasn't, you know.
Right.
And sometimes I guess you do. You lose touch. It's very easy to fool yourself for some people.
You know.
But before we go into that, we can let that alone. But I'm sure you deal. I guess that's also hard when you're a stuntman. And part of what makes stuntmen successful is having to play politics in a way. You've got to be somebody people want to work with. I mean, there are a lot of facets to it, man.
It's brutal. It's brutal.
Yeah, you got to be somebody who gets along with people, who understands camera angles, who understands how a film is shot, and then who has a skill set that can be applicable to, you know, you got to learn how to fall, you got to learn how to fight, you got to learn how to drive a car. You're doing all the driving stuff on you're doing a lot of driving stuff on Hangover 3 right now.
Yeah, I'll be doing a lot of drifting with actual limo.
What does drifting mean?
Drifting is when you drive the car when you've actually don't have traction on the rear wheels.
So there's a lot of technique to driving a car, like in everything, right?
Yeah. And there's actually a lot better guys in the business than myself.
Yeah, you were speaking very highly of a certain stuntman.
Yeah, there's some, you know.
What's his name?
Corey Eubanks is a phenomenal driver. Jack Gill is a great driver. There's a tremendous amount of good drivers in the business.
Yeah.
That, obviously, you know, the Harpers, there's tremendous guys that can drive better than I can. I'm an up-and-coming driver, and I'm getting better, hopefully, all the time. But, you know.
But you started out as fighting being your skill. Do you do motorcycle stuff?
I don't do motorcycle stuff.
Don't do horse stuff? You don't do motorcycle stuff?
I can do both. I can ride motorcycles. I can ride cars. I can drive cars, I can ride motorcycles, I can do horses, but I don't really call myself that kind of guy.
Yeah, because there are other guys that are outstanding.
There's guys that are phenomenal at it. You know what I mean? And look, if you're doing Fast and the Furious, or if you're doing one of those movies, am I your driver lead? No. You're going to go out and get the best guy on the planet.
Right.
And he's going to be able to do things in a car that I can't do.
It's like when we worked on Hangover 2, the best helicopter pilot in the world was there. He's like the Michael Jordan. Dude, that guy can put a helicopter on the side of a building. He can do everything. He was 4 feet away from the boat as they were driving. This guy was phenomenal. So yeah, there's enough diversity in the business, you know. But your thing is fighting. And
well, originally I got in from fighting. But I actually have a lot of skill sets that, lo and behold, end up being quite useful in the stunt industry.
Like what?
Well, one of my things that is kind of odd is I'm a 100-ton master captain, merchant marine. So I'm an ocean captain under the U.S. Coast Guard.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, I learned a lot about you, dude. I've known you a while now. And you know boats.
I know boats. And what boats gives me is, one, I'm a big surfer. So I surf and I free dive. So I'm really strong in the water, safety-wise. And boat-wise, I'm probably the most qualified guy to do any boat stunts in the business. How many people know that? Me and you right now. But in actual reality, I'm probably the most qualified.
But what would be
guy.
A boat stunt? Give me an example.
Well, if you remember Speed 2, where they rammed the giant cruise ship into a sailboat, that would be a boat stunt. And there's a lot of safety aspects that go in there that you need to address. You need to know about sailboats and the mechanics and the loads and what the rigging is.
How'd you learn about that? So you can sail across the ocean, you think?
Kind of like a standard.
That's a standard.
That's kind of what you do, yeah.
I would be very afraid to sail across the Pacific, for example, because of storms. What do you do when you get caught in a storm for 72 hours?
Well, there's not a lot you can do. You got to prepare your vessel for the weather, and you got to map the weather and know where it is and what you need to do and which direction you need to be traveling to get in and out of the weather. And unfortunately, sometimes you just have to ride it out. You have to deal with it.
And usually your boat will not tip. It'll just kind of bounce around like a cork.
Sometimes it'll pitch pole or it'll roll or it'll be damaged in weather. So you got to be prepared for those situations, and you got to be able to know what's the correct answer when those things happen.
Yeah, but I can't think of anything. Very few things that are that terrifying when you're in the middle of the ocean and all you see is blackness, which is what you see because I've been on a cruise.
Yeah.
And you're being pitched around in a sailboat.
I've been there.
You have?
Oh, yeah.
And what do? You just stay underground? You just stay?
No. I actually, one of the things I did, what I started doing just to see kind of what I was made of, what I could do and what I couldn't do, is I started doing deliveries, sailboat deliveries. I started delivering sailboats for people all over, wherever they need their boat delivered. So let's say you're a wealthy businessman in New York and you own a boat in Newport Beach. But next summer, you want to spend it in Santa Cruz. So you want your boat there. So you'd hire me. I'd go down, grab your boat, and I'd bring it up to Santa Cruz. Well, sometimes we have what's called bad weather deliveries in the winter when all the heavy storms are coming down from Alaska. Nobody wants to deliver boats up the coast. So I used to specifically take those deliveries that everybody else would decline.
You're a fucking nut.
So I would take boats that were maybe a bit small for the weather, and I would pretty much do the minimum crew legally that I had to do, and I would take a boat and I'd deliver it to see if I could do it, and I would put
myself
in a lot
of... And the less crew means the less people you have to pay.
Well, it's less people I have to be responsible for. When you're captaining, you're legally responsible for everybody on the vessel. You're responsible for the vessel. You're responsible for everybody on that vessel.
Okay.
So less guys I have, the better. And the guys I need to have with me are guys that are aware of what we're going into and are fully committed to that situation.
So you don't get seasick too easily?
No. Once you acclimate to a boat, you don't notice it at all.
That just comes from being able to move with the boat subconsciously.
Yeah, inner ear actually will actually move with it and burns up a tremendous amount of calories, actually. For people that don't go on boats, if you go on a boat and you get off a boat, all of a sudden you're exhausted.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, that's really tiring. Just that constant motion in your body trying to deal with it, it really wears you out. But when you stay on boats for days or weeks and months at a time. When you step on land, it actually feels like the land is moving. And you're like, whoa, whoa, what's going on? You're like, lose your balance because your body's making all these adjustments.
You got those sea legs
that you don't need anymore. Exactly. So, so I used to do that. I used to take boats up and deliver them. And on one occasion, I took a boat up and I got caught in a significant storm on a boat and literally was submerged 30, 40 times, completely submerged the whole boat under the water.
Because the waves were hitting it so hard?
Yeah, they would just submerge it.
Jesus.
It was pitch black at night.
Oh my God. Were you on deck?
I was on deck. I strapped myself in with a tether, harness and a tether. So I strapped in. I'm tied into the boat.
So are you going underwater?
Yeah, I was going completely underwater. And then the boat would shudder and pop back up like a quark. And then
that's very cold and not a fucking good time.
It was off the coast of San Francisco. So it was ice cold in the winter, freezing.
Oh, and there are a lot of great whites in that water, by the way.
40-mile-an-hour winds and 20-foot swells in pitch black and white caps breaking in all different directions.
Can you get a light on the water to see when it's hitting you?
No, you can hear it. You can hear it coming, and then you have to turn the boat really quickly and get it into the nose of the wave, so you want as much length on the wave as possible, length of the boat on the wave as possible. If those waves were to hit you from the side, they would roll you completely over. So you're constantly.
That's not what you want.
No, I did that for 14 hours, just sitting there fighting, spinning the wheel, just fighting, trying to keep the boat into the waves.
Dude.
Talking with the Coast Guard the whole time. They knew exactly where I was, and they actually tried to send out a Coast Guard heavy weather cutter. And when they went out to open ocean, they had to turn around and come back because the captain they had on the cutter wasn't qualified to drive in that weather. They had to go back and get an Alaskan heavy weather captain because it was that
bad.
This
is fascinating.
And so, he ended up coming. I had my crew underneath all battened down in the boat. I was the only one on the top. And
were you just frozen?
Yeah, it was cold. It was my.
What were you wearing? What are you wearing in that situation? It doesn't matter because you're fucking wet anyway.
Yeah, you're soaked to the bone. But I had a wetsuit underneath, heavy weather gear. But you're just soaked in salt water and freezing cold salt water, and your whole body. If you've never seen your whole body peel, like peel for days, for weeks, your hands. You know how your hands get like.
Yeah. How long were you out on deck? How long were you dealing?
I did that particular stretch for 20 hours. The heavy weather like that was for 14 to 20 hours. So I finally
you
got
were
a
on deck for 14 to 20 hours doing that shit.
Yeah,
you straight. Could. That's crazy.
Yeah, but you don't have really a choice. It's not like you can say,
these waves were not letting up for four. And were you covering ground or were you kind of?
No,
stuck?
I was standing dead still. I was fighting for 14 hours just to stay still and stay off the rocks.
Because that's what you had to do. You had to stay off the rocks and deliver that boat in one fucking piece.
Right.
How much did the boat cost?
It wasn't that much of a boat. Maybe a $150,000 boat.
Oh, that's
at
all.
That time. But that's not much for a sailboat. It's really not.
Really?
It was a smaller boat. It was a 36 footer, which isn't big.
Right.
It was a little bit older.
How much can you pay for a sailboat?
That size, up to $500,000. Anywhere from $500,000 all the way down to $75,000.
You paying for craftsmanship? Are you paying for electronics on the boat?
No, you're paying for name and bullshit mostly. Yeah. The best boats.
So for 14 to 20 hours, you're sitting there fighting these ridiculous waves.
Yeah, it was funny. And I was constantly in contact with the Coast Guard. So I knew it was going to happen. Once we got caught in, I knew it was happening. So I knew they were 2 hours away. So I told them right away, like, hey, this is where I'm at. This is where I hope
to be. What did you want them to do? Pick you up?
Well, what they can do is then come in and take my passengers off the vessel if necessary, and then you let the vessel go and you lose the boat.
You just lose the boat.
Unfortunately, yeah. Lives are way more valuable than a boat. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a boat. You have insurance. That's it's part of the business. Boats get lost every
day. And you
were
looking to do that, obviously, because that's a terrible place to be.
I wasn't looking to do that. I thought I could get out of it. So what I did is I just kind of kept them in contact and let them know where I was. And then when I saw, like, because I had a motor running, and that's what was keeping me standing still. And then when I realized I wasn't making any headway at all.
20-foot swells.
Yeah.
In pitch black.
Yeah, pitch night. Yeah.
Yeah, fuck that.
Well, Someone's got to do it.
And you don't know, how do you keep track of where you are and how do you know that rocks
are? Well, you have a compass and you have land masses that you can see. There's lighthouses and land masses you can see, and you have star configuration from so that you can kind of give yourself a good fixed position. You got to learn how to give yourself travel and fixed positions.
And you were basically standing still for that long.
Standing still, yeah.
So when the storm finally broke.
Didn't break, actually. They finally came. I finally said, look, I'm going to be out of fuel in about an hour and 30 minutes. So you guys need to come and grab us. So they came, and what I ended up doing is set up a tow line and had them tow us in on their cutter. So they sat in front of us and breakaway force, and they just tow us. And so we ended up doing that. But it was funny because...
They towed you into where?
Into San Francisco Bay.
And then you were okay?
Yeah, once you got into the bay, the weather was
fine. How did you feel after that crazy ordeal?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Felt good.
I love stuntmen. You're a nut, dude.
Well, look, at your worst possible fear you could ever run into as a captain is exactly that. You're in a storm in a boat that's way outmatched.
Well, what would be a boat that could deal with that?
Bigger boat? If I was on a 54-footer or a 62-footer, I would have been... I would have been doing 30, you know, I've been doing 24 knots.
Oh, you would have just opened the motors up?
No, I would have sailed it. With a 60-footer, I would have sailed it and just been making headway.
You would have sailed it?
Oh, yeah. I've been doing 20 miles an hour, having a blast.
Really?
Yeah.
So the bigger the boat, you can actually sail.
Absolutely.
20-foot swells. You ride the waves.
If you had like a large white bread, like what we call a world-class racer, if you had like a white bread 70-foot class, like what we do the Volvo World or Transpac in, sometimes they'll race Transpac. If you had a boat like that.
You want that kind of
weather. Those guys are jerking off for 40-mile-an-hour winds.
Really?
Yeah. They're like, oh, man, we're going to make some good time.
Is your boat going 40 miles an hour when you have 40-mile-an-hour winds?
Some boats can do that. Some boats can match wind speed. Or
40 miles an hour on the water is very fast.
It's retarded. Yeah, the newer
boats fall off a boat in that weather, you're done.
You're gone.
You die.
Well, there's two schools of thought. You have what's called an EPIRB system. It's
By the way, this is a man conversation. Yeah. This is why we call this shit man thoughts. I should just call this man talk. I don't know why I call it man thoughts, but fuck it. But it is man
it's
thoughts.
Catchy.
But yeah. So
what you have is you have an EPIRB, which is a basically what an EPIRB is. It's a personal GPS device for rescue and safety. Skiers use it as well. Climbers, hikers use it. It works on GPS satellites anywhere in the world. And so you'll have one on your life vest. And let's say you're racing a Transpac or Volvo and you fall off. And those boats are doing 50, 60 miles an hour. You fall off. By the time they turn around, you're a quarter mile behind them. So there's a few systems you can do. You hit the water, boom, you turn your EPIRB on. Also, when you hit the water, they'll have a GPS unit on board with like an emergency stop button. So when you hear man overboard, you slap the emergency stop button, and that records the GPS location of where that person fell off.
Okay.
So when you turn back, you can go back to that.
Okay.
But because it takes you so long to turn around and come back, and if there's heavy weather, a guy can literally be 20 feet away from your boat. But because he's only a foot out of the water,
you can't see him.
You can't see him because any swell is going to hide him. So you physically can't see him. He could be right by your boat.
Yeah.
You can't see him. Now, if he has EPIRBs on him, you can find him with GPS.
What's EPIRBs?
EPIRBs is a GPS unit, like a low jack.
Yeah, you got to like have that. You got to have that.
Well, there's two schools of thoughts for a lot of professional racers. Some racers will have it and hope to be rescued. Other racers figure, I'm dead. I'd rather die sooner than later. So they don't wear any rescue vests. They don't wear anything. They just want to drown immediately and die.
Why?
Because the sad reality is a lot of times, if you're falling off, you're getting injured while it's happening.
Okay.
Because a wave is ripping you off the boat. So you just got slammed against the boat, probably injured yourself. You're unconscious or you're bleeding. You're in the water. You're not going to get found.
Yeah.
So would you rather sit there for 16, 17 hours and then die? Or would you rather die immediately? So
the worry is I'd be scared of sharks. But the truth is you die of hypothermia.
Exactly.
Or drowning way before a shark gets you.
Sometimes sharks do get you.
Is that true?
Absolutely. In World War II,
yeah.
There was always a tremendous amount of shark attacks and huge feedings
You know,
so if you go overboard in the ocean, there is a chance the sharks can get you.
Absolutely. If you're injured and there's blood, yeah, absolutely. Sharks eat. And if they sense blood in the water, they're gonna come and take a snack. They
don't have See, guys, this is why I don't fucking sail in the open ocean. This is why I'm an actor/comedian/podcast host, okay? Because even though it's called Man Thoughts, I'm not man enough, like my boy Kieran here, to get in a boat and sail it like that. That's crazy. What a fascinating thing. I had no idea you knew about... You're always full of surprises, brother. Hmm. Unbelievable.
Well, the reason that ties into stunts is because everything we do in sailing is rigging. All rigging comes from sailing. Sailing is the first...
Yeah, when you're doing rock climbing, it's all knots. It
comes from sailing.
Yeah.
Sailing was around before rock climbing. Yeah. So all the knowledge, all the knowledge of ropes and rigging and gear comes from sailing. So really all the stunt rigging and stunts comes from rock climbing and sailing. And I grew up rock climbing with my older brothers. My older brothers taught me to rock climb at a very young age. I didn't do it for many years, so it took me some time to get back into it. But so I had a very good, strong foundation of rigging for climbing and climbing. And then my sailing background is really rigging for stunts is like a poor man's version of rigging for sailing. Mm. Because we're dealing with such larger loads,
yeah.
So much more pressure. Sure. We're dealing with sails that are creating 25,000 pounds of force. And we're rigging that with small pulleys, lines. So you have to know what can do what.
It's so
and
technical.
What shackles and hardware will do what and how to manipulate the force.
When was the last time? I know you surf still, but when was the last time you sailed?
I sailed last month. Last month, yeah. I used to own a boat here in Marina. I sold it last year.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So you
sold it to a producer, Brett Roski, a gentleman who is doing a web series.
So
web series right now.
You've been, so you still sail actively?
Still sail actively. I'll rent boats here and there sometimes.
Did you ever, when you were out there, you ever see any whales or sharks
all the time.
Or dolphins?
I see dolphins all the time, sharks all the time, seals all the time.
You see sharks too?
Yeah, absolutely. You have sharks follow the boats a lot.
When you're up on the tuna deck, you can see them or whatever when you're up
on just when you're on a regular sailboat on a flat deck, yeah, you can see them. Sharks have, fish have learned to hide underneath boats because sharks hunt from beneath. So what sharks like to do is they like to go below, look up, and they see silhouettes. Because the light's shining down, they see a silhouette.
Yeah.
So that's how sharks, like great whites, hit seals.
Yeah.
Great whites swim below, they look up,
so
they see
a
silhouette.
If you fall off a boat, there are sharks probably a lot of times following the boat.
Exactly, because what happens is fish started to learn that they could hide underneath boats and that would hide their silhouettes. Well, sharks also learned fish like to hide under boats, so sharks like to follow boats. And sharks have learned in the last 50 years or 100 years that humans love to throw shit off boats. And sharks like to follow boats and get free shit to eat, waste, and other products.
That's
a reality.
That's my buddy. When he was a kid, they used to when they'd sail in Montauk, you'd hold on to a line, and they drag you. They drag you behind the boat. And there was a guy who was a fisherman who said, you know, to my buddy's mom, my buddy Kurt Kohler, I think it was Kurt, and it was a long time ago. But I remember Kurt's mom saying, "You're not doing that anymore," because I talked to a fisherman who said, "That's a bad idea because we got great whites out here. And if you're hanging off a boat like that, you're food, bro. You're trolling for sharks in some ways." So
absolutely. You ever watch any of the National Geographic specials? They drag a buoy behind the boat that looks like a seal and pow, that's how they get sharks to breach.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. That's how you get those beautiful shots and footage and video of sharks breaching.
Sharks breaching.
It's guys dragging stuff behind boats.
Speaking of which, there are a lot of great whites right off the coast of Malibu and Santa Monica and Venice.
They just caught one off Manhattan Beach Pier a week ago.
How big?
It broke line, but they had it for a little while. It was
a great white.
Great white, yeah.
Yeah.
It casting off of Manhattan Beach
Pier. Yeah, there you go.
Casting from the pier.
From the pier.
Yeah.
Yeah, no thanks.
So he's within 50 feet of the pier.
Yeah, that's why I'm not going swimming in that water anymore. I've had it. I mean, and for some reason, great whites are coming closer to shore, and they don't know why. So maybe there's not as much food out there. I don't know. What are your other skill sets, man? That's a lot to learn.
That helped me with the rigging, and then I did a lot of small arms combat training and other types of training with some special forces guys. So my military training as far as weapons is high grade. And then obviously my fight background was kind of my strong
skill set. When it comes to pistols, and I should be asking a soldier maybe, but I know you've trained with these guys, and we talked a little bit about it, but when it comes to pistols, you were showing me that a lot of times guys, if they're bodyguards or whatever, they'll keep the pistol really close to their chest.
Yeah, the really best pistol guys
are Delta guys, right? Because this my buddy did a podcast with, who was a Ranger Special Forces guy who worked with JSOC, you know, like Joint Special Operations right. Command. I mean, he was in the top tier with he actually worked with SEAL Team 6 and Delta, and he said you can always tell a Delta guy because they got calluses on their hands because they use their pistols so much, right. They just shoot so much, right. Because that's when you can tell a Delta guy he's got a pistol callus on his fucking hand.
Right. Well, that's funny you say that, because in my experience, I've worked and trained with Delta guys and SEAL guys, and there we actually have some SEAL guys in stunts.
Yeah,
you'll run into some ex-Navy SEALs in stunts. In my experience, the actual best shooters, the best guys with a pistol.
Let me guess.
Go ahead.
I mean, they might just be competition shooters, right?
The best guys you want shooting for you.
Yeah.
Are air marshals.
Oh, that's fucking right.
The air marshals.
They have to, because
they're on a plane.
Oh, air marshals.
And the guys who run the Air Marshal Training Academy, the shooters there are the best shooters, combat shooters you're ever going to see.
Is that right?
These guys have to wear respirators because they get lead poisoning they shoot so much.
No.
Okay.
No fucking way.
They literally,
I love this,
get lead poisoning.
Dude, you didn't want to come on this podcast because you're like, I don't have much to say. This is fascinating. This shit is fascinating.
But
to me.
I can tell
this
you
is perfect.
I can tell you a story of a good friend of mine who is an air marshal, uh-huh, who came out of Afghanistan as an airborne ranger, okay, special force. If you ever see the documentary Repo Stop about that base that gets overrun, he was the guy who set up Repo Stop.
Oh, wait a minute. Repo Stop was the base where the Taliban revolted. What's it? That I saw it and I wanted to know the name of it. That was so badass. Because they showed a lot of real, like, shady American characters on that.
Right.
Like that dude who with the AK-47 with the scarf. Who was he? What was he? Do you remember that guy?
I don't remember the details.
But that was where John Michael Spann got killed. It was called, right, Repo Stop.
Repo Stop.
Why did it call it? Why was it called Repo Stop?
Repo Stop, I believe, and I might be 100% wrong. Repo Stop is when you're on a contract with the U.S. government to do like 2 years.
Oh, okay. You guys, that's a great documentary because I watched that and I loved it. And I can't believe you're telling me what it was because I've always wondered what it was called. Okay, yeah. So Repo Stop. So I'm sorry. So he was there?
He was actually the officer that set that base camp up. And when he cycled out, the team that is in Repo Stop cycled in.
Okay.
So he actually said some of the training videos that you see are actually from his team being attacked by Taliban.
Wow.
Like the training videos of Humvees being trapped on pasts,
yeah,
in a triangle formation where the Taliban used to like to sit right above them so they, yeah, could shoot down in the back of the heads of the turret drivers.
Yeah.
Those attacks are actually his caravan being attacked. He's in those Humvees in those videos being filmed by the Taliban.
Jesus.
That they now use as training videos on how to prepare for those attacks from high elevations.
Man.
When he got out, he went into the air marshals. And when he was waiting to go in the air marshals, he lived with me. And he used to train with a few other guys that had gotten out of the military, some Delta Force guys and some Navy SEAL guys. And they'd all go shooting together and to practice. And I'd show him some techniques like hand-to-hand combat techniques for close combat, things like that, how to make space between somebody so you could use your weapon, because that's ultimately what you want to do. You don't want to fight an MMA fight with some guy on a plane.
No.
You want to make space with his ass, and then you want to blast holes in him. Get your weapon and blast holes in him. So, you know, I just showed him how to control shucks and get guys off of him and control space, and if he does go on his back, don't wrap into the guard tight, but how to make space out.
You're
going to
be doing that for me, by the way.
So you can blast.
Just
guys.
In case I get into a situation on a fucking, right, plane.
And so he said, you know, the Navy SEAL guys are really good shooters. The Delta guys are really good shooters. And he was a very good shooter himself. He was as good as they were. When he came back from Air Marshal School, he said he felt like he'd never shot a pistol in his life.
Yeah.
Those guys made them look
stupid. By the
way,
you know who's really good at shooting? Kids who play video games now.
Yeah.
These kids are with a couple adjustments at 16 years old are shooting as good as SWAT team guys and Delta guys because they've been doing it since they were three. That's what's so crazy. These kids are getting headshots.
Yeah, it's very similar skill set.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so he was telling me these crazy stories about how the Air Marshal shooting instructor was doing all these drills that none of them could do. He was shooting ways that they could not do, none of them. The Delta guys, the SEAL guys, himself, said he felt silly. And literally the guy had to take days off. The instructor had to take off because he had lead poisoning. Because he shoots so much.
You got to fucking wear a respirator. That's when you know you're a fucking badass.
You shoot a lot.
That's shooting a lot. It's like anything else, man. The more you train, the more you practice, you know.
When you have an endless supply.
That gun becomes, the gun actually becomes an extension of you. Because I know that those guys shoot with both eyes open, and they just learn how to point where they're shooting. Right? I mean, you get very good at pointing and shooting. I mean, that's basically what it is. Where you look, you're going to shoot. I would imagine that your eye and the gun kind of start to become one, you know?
I'm an okay shot. I'm certainly not like them, but a lot of guys use different ways to control the gun.
Do you shoot with both eyes open or do you shoot with...
I shoot with both eyes open.
You do?
And I aim with my shoulders. I aim with my shoulders and my chest. I don't aim with my eyes so much.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because the problem with me shooting with two eyes open is I'm left eye dominant or right eye dominant, so I have to close my left eye if I want to shoot. Does that make sense? So I wouldn't be a very good soldier. Damn.
The only problem is
I'm
that
a better comedian.
The only problem is that takes time.
I know it does. That's why, again, I wouldn't be an Air Marshal or a Delta guy or a SEAL guy. I'll tell you why else I wouldn't be a SEAL guy. I hate the cold, okay? I don't like that shit, and I don't have the physicality. So
it's funny is that you know, in all these movies you always see, you always think of Navy SEAL guys as like Charlie Sheen on steroids, who's just going to go into a bar, do eight shots, and kick the shit out of everybody. But really what your Navy SEALs are guys that were phenomenal cross-country runners in high school.
Yeah.
Were great swim team captains.
Yeah.
These are really...
And wrestlers, actually. Yeah. SEAL team guys have a lot of good wrestlers.
These are really your SEAL guys, or guys that came out of endurance sports. Guys that could just go, okay, you got to run for 10 hours. All right.
Yep.
I can wrap my mind around that. Yep. I'll run for 10 hours.
That's what it is. I mean, you gotta be able to bear down. You have a pack on your back, and you are, I mean, you if in a combat situation or at war, you're not sleeping a lot. You know, you're dealing with sleep deprivation, food deprivation, cold deprivation. Yeah. You've got to be basically stubborn. The one thing I've noticed about, like, you know, guys, actually, frankly, like you as well, is, you know, a lot of soldiers I've talked to are very black and white, matter of fact guys. They're not psychically complicated. They're not overthinking a lot of stuff. They're pretty, you know, pretty black and white and pretty. I don't want to use the word simple because they're intelligent guys, but they're not complicated about their thought process.
Well, you can't be complicated when you have to make quick decisions. You got to kind of simplify things just to make it easier to do.
Dude, we've talked for an hour and 10 minutes, and I usually stop this at an hour, but you've touched on some pretty fascinating stuff, man.
Well, I hope you'll edit this down to like 10 minutes.
No, dude, you had a lot to say, and you'll be surprised how much people you say a lot of stuff that a lot of guys don't know. Like, you know, this is interesting shit for guys, and I'm sure for some girls, but mostly for guys. I mean, you know, just that stuff about sailing and you know, I wish people could watch an MMA fight with you or watch the UFC fight with you to really get an understanding of your knowledge, the depth of your knowledge when it comes to why guys are better. And I know you call fights and you're always right. And even when I argue with you, you always prove me wrong. But that's for another time. the sailing stuff was fascinating, man. Kieran Gallagher. Thank you very much, and have fun on Hangover 3. I know you'll do great.
Well, it won't be the same without you.
That's what I like to hear, brother.
I'll have to figure out a way to write you into that.
I'm not in the movie, at least not now. I don't know what's going
to
happen.
I'll have to write you in there somehow.
They'll have to write me in. Tell Todd Phillips I say hi, the director, writer. All right, guys, this has been another episode of Man Thoughts with Brian Callen. Thank you for tuning in. And once again, I will be at the Brea Improv. I think by the time you hear this, I won't be there. I'll have done it already. And I will be at Minneapolis, the House of Comedy in Minneapolis, which is in the Mall of America, September 18th, 19th, 20th, 20th, and 21st. Or maybe it's the 19th, 20th, 21st, 22nd. I'm hopeless, but just look it up on their website. And come say hi after the show. I love taking pictures and saying hi and whatever. All right, man. Thanks for listening. Later.
You've been listening to Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.